You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. So I'm pleased to welcome you tonight to two novelists of what we call protean imagination, Miley Malloy and Marissa Silver. And I was looking up the word protean, multifaceted, multi-talented, many-sided. Proteus, the god who had the ability to assume many forms, and I think it's quite apt. Their two novels, most recent novels, are set in worlds utterly apart, far apart, but they're both works of great skill, constructed with deep consideration for their characters. Do Not Become Alarmed, such a great title, is Miley Malloy's third novel for adults. It's an emotional thriller in which the whole idea of safety is an illusion. It's about what happens when two American families board a cruise ship in Southern California with a plan to travel down the coasts of Mexico and Central America. And during an off-ship expedition in an unnamed country, the children float off into unforeseen peril. Her last two novels are Liars and Saints, a multi-generational history of a sprawling Catholic clan in California, and A Family Daughter, which depicts the earlier novel as the creation of one of its own fictional characters. As Laura Miller wrote on Slate, in Malloy's fiction, quote, stories spiral out of stories. Miley Malloy is also the author of a wonderful series of middle grade fiction, beginning with The Apothecary, which I just sent off to my 10-year-old grandniece at summer camp. She's going to be very excited. Miley has received the Paris Review's Aga Khan Prize, the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Short Story, the Academy of Arts and Letters Rosenthal Foundation Award, and a Guggenheim Fellowship. And Marissa Silver's new novel, Little Nothing, is a tale as mysterious as anything the Grimm brothers might have collected. It takes place in an unfamiliar place and time, in a fairy tale-like world that's strange and archetypal, somewhere in Eastern Europe. A woman screams and a baby is born, but she's not right. She's more, her mother says, like a rag doll sewn together from cast-off parts. In her past two novels, Marissa Silver has explored the role that trauma plays in shaping identity. In Mary Coyne, that trauma is the Great Depression. In The God of War, she explores the effect that the shooting of a young boy has on two brothers. She's also the author of No Direction Home and Babe in Paradise, and her stories, criticism, and essays have appeared in many publications, including The New York Times and The New Yorker, and she's a recent recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship. Both these award-winning novelists know how to subvert expectations in their gripping works while maintaining a deep commitment to the emotions of their characters. And both of these very different novels reveal how accidental incidents change the course of fate. As storytellers, what are their common and differing strategies? How do they find their way into their characters? And how do their stories reveal themselves as they work? We'll hear from both Miley and Marissa reading from their new novels, and then we'll have the pleasure of listening in on their conversation. Then we will open to you for questions. We will circulate microphones as we do record for podcast. And we always appreciate if you make your question a question. That would be great. We'll take as many as we can. And then afterwards, both of our authors will be signing their works in the lobby, courtesy of our library store. So we'll begin tonight with a reading by Miley. Please welcome our two novelists, Miley Malloy and Marissa Silver.
Hi. Nice to see people I know. I'm Miley Malloy. I thought I'd talk just briefly about the book before I read. Sometimes it's hard to say what your book is about. This one's really easy. It's about two families who go on vacation. The kids go missing. In 2011, I was reading the novel A High Wind in Jamaica. Has anyone read A High Wind in Jamaica? Ooh, that's a lot of people. It's a 1929 novel by Richard Hughes about kids who get accidentally taken by pirates. The pirates really don't want the kids. Because they don't want to get in trouble, and the kids mostly love being on the pirate ship. And it's about kids who don't know how much danger they're in because they're kids. And I read it and thought, I want to write a novel like that about that. And a cruise ship seemed like a good place to start it because it seems like a safe cocoon where everything is provided and the kids can run around by themselves and it's kind of insular, but it's still a ship at sea and you look over the railing and there's a 14-story drop to churning water. Some people have told me they can't read about kids in danger. Because I've been writing kids' books and talking to talking to middle schoolers for 6 years, that's always strange to me because kids' books are entirely about kids in danger. That's all fifth graders read. And also because kids are in danger all the time in the real world. And the reader always knows where the kids are, so it's not like the kids just vanish and you don't know anything. You follow the kids. So I think in some ways this was a natural way for me to come back from writing the trilogy for kids, was to write a novel for grown-ups in which kids are having an adventure, but you also stay with the parents. In a kid's book, you have to get rid of the parents as quickly as possible for the adventure to happen, and this one stays with the parents who are freaking out. It's set in January 2016, so it's a historical novel, which I didn't know while I was writing it. There's also a child who's traveling north to try to get to her parents who are in the United States. Most of the book takes place in Central America. So it's about two North American families and two Central American families and two South American families from very different countries, and sort of what happens when they all, when their lives become intertwined. I think that's all you need to know. The two American mothers are Liv and Nora, and they're cousins who grew up together. And the children are, their children are, two kids are 11, one is 8 and one is 6. And then they've run into an Argentinian family on the ship who have teenagers who are very glamorous and kind of aspirational, who are 14 and 15. And the women and the children have all gone ashore, and a series of things have gone wrong, and they're going to a beach which was not planned with the guide who was supposed to take them ziplining. I think that's all you need to know. There were 10 of them. Liv, Penny, Sebastian, Nora and her children, Camilla and the Argentinian teens, all following Pedro. Liv thought they must look absurd, trooping along on the shoulder, carrying inner tubes. But a trail soon veered off from the road, and Pedro led them into the trees. The undergrowth seemed ready to reclaim the trail the moment humans stopped trampling it. Pedro stopped, and Nora bumped into him. Marcus, holding an inner tube, bumped into Nora, and Liv bumped into Marcus. "Sorry," she said. "Up there," Pedro whispered, pointing. A magnificent bird was perched on a branch above them, green with a blue head and a black mask. It had a long double tail with teardrop blue feathers at the end. It turned its head, revealing an orangey brown throat. "What is it?" Nora whispered. "Blue-crowned motmot." "See the bird?" Liv whispered to Penny and Sebastian, and they oohed appropriately. How had evolution made that? The bird flew off, trailing its ludicrous tail. Real nature. Her kids were too protected. This unexpected adventure would be good for them. They trooped on. Nora and Pedro chatted about birds. Sebastian and June scampered ahead. The trees opened, and they walked out onto a pretty little beach at the mouth of a river, just as Pedro had promised. They could see the protective reef in the distance, and no surf made it inside. It was perfect. The children clamored for their bathing suits. "Where do we change?" Penny asked. "Right here," Liv said. Penny looked doubtful, but she wasn't going to miss swimming for the sake of modesty. Hector peeled off his polo shirt. Isabel was already in a yellow bikini, her adolescent hips and small breasts resplendent in it. She must have had it on under her sundress. Liv averted her eyes and checked her phone again. Still no signal. She held up a towel for the children to change and smeared more sunscreen on their faces and shoulders while they squirmed and squinted. She removed Sebastian's insulin pump and sealed the port with its plastic cap. Then she looked to Pedro. "You promise there's nothing dangerous in that water?" "I go in first," Pedro said. He had stripped down to nylon hiking shorts. He had an interesting scar on the side of his belly, like a deep thumbprint. Appendix? And the pale sunburst of a smallpox vaccination above his brown tricep. Those were not first world scars, Liv thought. He waded into the water, and she was happy to see that it was shallow for a long way. He stepped carefully forward. When he was chest deep, he screamed and was yanked under, leaving a small splash at the surface. "Oh, shit," Liv said, leaping to her feet. Isabel screamed. "Mommy," June cried. Pedro surfaced, smiling, then looked at their appalled faces and grew serious. "I am so sorry," he said. "This was not a good joke. Everything is fine, you see?" He stood waist deep and held up his hands. His shining hair and his smooth bare chest dripped with water. He looked cool as they sweltered. Liv wanted to strangle him. "Oh my God," Nora said. Camilla said something angry in fast Spanish, and Pedro apologized again. Liv's children looked to her, uncertain. There was no point in showing her rage. She breathed and smiled. "Be calm, be reassuring." "He was just teasing us for being afraid," she said. "It was a joke. There's nothing dangerous. Do you want to swim?" They nodded. It was much too hot not to want to swim. Liv was conscious of her pale thighs in her swimsuit after feeling so attractive and young on the ship. Was it because Pedro was here? Was it because he clearly liked Nora? Why did she care about the idiot guide? She thought motherhood had cauterized her vanity. She tugged down the leg holes of the suit and tried to shake the feeling off. "Okay, you two," she said to Sebastian and Penny. "Race you in." The water was warm and the children played on the three inner tubes, their happy cries piercing the air. Liv swam alongside them for a while. She felt no current and the water was barely salty. When she was tired of swimming, she told Penny to keep an eye on her brother. "I'm okay," Sebastian said. "I know," she said lightly. "Just come in if you feel tired." She knew Penny understood what she was asking, but she also knew her daughter would have rolled her eyes if she thought she could get away with it. She got out and toweled off. The kids kept swimming and shrieking. Pedro produced some frozen rum drink from two thermos bottles and poured it into plastic cups. It was slushy and sweet in the heat and felt decadent, but it was so deliciously cold. "The drinks were supposed to be for after the zip line," he said. The taste reminded Liv of a spring break in her lost youth, sand on her sun-warmed body, a cute boy from Arizona she had hardly known, with a compact body like the guide's. Pedro played some music on his phone, a man rapping and a woman singing. He leaned back on his elbows in the sand, singing to the girl's part. Liv didn't need a translation. It was all about sex. But Nora asked for one. "The man says she's so beautiful," Pedro said. "She says, don't try it. I know what you want." "Got it," Nora said, smiling out at the water. This flirtation was the kind of thing Liv might have shared a glance with Nora about if it had been someone else flirting, but she couldn't because it was Nora. It was disorienting. She flipped through a New Yorker from her bag. Nora's shadow came over her. "Will you keep an eye on the kids?" she asked. "Pedro heard some special bird call." Liv squinted up at her, astonished. "Okay," she said. Then Pedro and Nora walked into the trees. Liv put the magazine down and stared after them. She wondered, not for the first time, if Nora felt physically eclipsed being married to Raymond, a man so widely desired. His fans wrote to him online and openly wished Nora didn't exist. Liv wondered if the eclipsed feeling was enough to push Nora to go make out with Pedro in the trees, just as proof of her own attractiveness. She lay on her back on a towel and watched the children from under her sun hat. They were strong swimmers. Hector and Isabel were out there, old enough to babysit. And there was Camilla, too, reading a mystery novel in Spanish. and Penny was watching Sebastian. The day was so sultry, the sun so warm, that Liv couldn't keep her eyes open. If she'd been driving, she would have pulled over, but she wasn't driving. She blinked and struggled and drifted deliciously into sleep. Thank you.
That was wonderful. First, I just want to thank Louise and the organization for inviting us. It's so wonderful to be here. You should have done that. You're usually so. And it's particularly fun to be here with Miley, whose work I really have admired for so long, and who has become a friend, I'm happy to say, and it's really fun to share this evening. So now for something just 100% different. You know, we've spent a lot of days going like, what is the same about our books? How are we going to? There are certain similarities, which hopefully we'll get to when we have a discussion. But this is a book about transformation, in particular the transformation that one young girl goes through over a lifetime. She is born a dwarf, and through a series of very unusual things that happen to her, she is stretched. And then she grows, but this in becoming stretched and growing tall, she also begins a series of transformations which take her in and out of human form as various things happen to her. It's a sort of hard book to describe. It acts a little bit like a fairy tale of old. It takes place, as Louise said, in a country that's unnamed and a time that's unspecified, but sort of, you know, early part of the 20th century Eastern Europe. And it's a book that sort of makes way for the uncanny and for the surreal, and hopefully through that gets to issues that might be familiar to all of us in the way that fairy tales do. So I'm going to read you a little section. Pavla is the name of the young girl, and she has been stretched at this point, so she's no longer a dwarf, but in the act of being stretched, she's also taken on the characteristics that are almost a little bit animal-like, and she has fur on her body, or hair on her body, and she, her face has become slightly pointed, so she's become a sort of strange-looking young woman, at which point her parents, who are very old and who live in a very sort of rural village, really don't know what the hope is for her in her life, and so they allow the doctor who did the stretching to take her off their hands, and he takes her into the world of the carnivals, the traveling carnivals, where she becomes an attraction called the Wolf Girl. And she is traveling with this man whose name is Smetanka, as well as his young assistant named Danilo, who is her friend. So this catches them during their time at the carnival. Pavla did not blame Danilo then and does not blame him now for what happened. And even though she was angry with her parents for wanting her to change, she does not blame them either. How could they or anyone have known what would happen to her? That she would not only grow, as they had hoped, but that with her height would come this other, unbidden disfigurement. But just as she learned that love is not always kind and is never simple, she does not allow herself to mistake Danilo's interest in her for anything other than what it is, a blend of guilt and pity and decency. During the long, slow drives following the parade of ramshackle conveyances that carry the fat man and the giant man and the three-headed snake and all the other attractions from one town to the next, Smetanka sleeps off the previous night's drunk in the back of the caravan while she sits next to Danilo on the wagon bench. Sometimes they trade carnival gossip about the separate romances of the conjoined Chinese twins. All Danilo has to say is, "Can you please look the other way?" And he and Pavla fall against each other laughing. But as their bodies meet and then part and then meet again, their laughter becomes self-conscious so that every sort snort of the horse or crack of stones underneath a hoof feels as embarrassing as if one of them had burped. They fall silent, and lulled by the slow rocking of the wagon and the nearness of him, she drifts into daydreams. He will put his hands on her face. He will brush her lips with his. He will... But the fantasy only serves to make her acutely aware of its implausibility. For how does she differ from Ling Ling and Ting Ting, whose names are really Marika and Marketa, and who are from a village not far from Pavlo's, but who are transformed into Oriental exotics by virtue of white face paint and black coal? or from Rasta, who is so thin that you can see every vein and bone in his body through his nearly pellucid skin, or Juliska, whose folds of belly fat fall down to her knees, or Leopold, who can swallow a padlock, a colored ball, and a live mouse, chase all of it down with a pint of ale, then regurgitate everything in whatever order the crowd demands. Perhaps just now the others are having a laugh at her expense, of her hairy cheeks, which Smetanka forbids her to shave, or her ears, which twitch when she is nervous. If it weren't for the clatter and squeal of the wagon wheels, she might be able to hear them, for her ears capture sound she has never heard before. At night, she can hear worms inching up the sides of the caravan. She can hear a blade of grass rub against its neighbor. How could he want her? The two leave the tent and walk out into the crisp night. Her stretched muscles have mostly healed, but walking is painful. Knowing this, Danilo moves slowly. Anyway, there is no rush to get back to the caravan. As tired as they are, sleep only means that the next night will come that much more quickly, and with it, more humiliation. They pass the fortune teller's tent. Inside, her lamp is still burning. A gust of wind and the wooden board advertising Fortunate Frantishka knocks against its post. You don't have money to waste, Pavla says, but she knows Danilo won't be able to resist throwing away his pitiful salary on Frantishka the faker, as Pavla refers to the old woman. You're the one who said all time exists, Danilo said. The past exists, the future exists. It's true, she did say this. And she does somehow believe that what has happened to her and what will happen to her exists simultaneously, that the story is already written but not yet told. She must be like someone in one of her mother's tales who has existed for centuries of telling and will exist even after her mother is gone. How else to explain her life? As something random? You said we just have to look hard and we will see what will happen to us, he continues. Frantishka can't even see her own hand in front of her face, she says, laughing. Her voice is a girl's, but her laugh is a short, scratchy, inhuman bark. Behold, a blind woman who can see the future, Danilo says dramatically, imitating Frantishka's husband when he tries to draw people to their tent. The joke around the carnival, that is, if Frantishka could have known that the only man on earth who would fuck her was the one with a goiter the size of a melon protruding from the side of his neck, she would have foreseen her death and killed herself. There is some rumor that Frantishka is not blind at all, that the impairment is simply a gimmick thought up by her canny husband. Someone saw her walk clear across the carnival grounds without once stepping in the mule turds that the animals drop as they carry children on laborious circuits around the amusements. Someone else claims to have caught her staring at herself in a mirror. Come with me, Danilo says, just once. I'd prefer to eat, she says, jangling her change purse. I'll pay for us both. She sighs. You're an idiot, she says fondly, following him. Inside, the tent is painted blood red, and the flickering lamp casts an eerie glow over everything, including the old, shriveled woman who sits at her velvet-draped table tearing apart a piece of ham with her fingers. Go away, I'm done for the night, she says. Then why is your lamp still lit, Pavla says. How would I know if it's lit or not? That rascal who calls himself my husband has not bothered to drag himself home tonight to close up, so here I am, trying to eat my supper and having to fend off the likes of you, she sniffs. It's that little goat girl, isn't it? Wolf girl, Danilo says. It all smells the same to me. Pavla, like all the resident freaks, is used to talk like this and takes no offense. Anyway, she is too busy trying to suss out whether the woman is a scammer or not. She looks around the tent for clues. A full-length mirror stands against an upended trunk, although a cloth covers the glass. Crude paintings of turbaned mystics and one of an open hand with an eye in the center of the palm hang on the tent poles. But the decorations could just as easily be there to create an air of foreign mystery for the fortune teller's patrons as for Frantishka's ocular enjoyment. Certainly the painting of the woman clothed in nothing but a diaphanous scarf that winds its way like a snake between her legs and over one breast must be there for the pleasure of her husband, who is right this moment probably spending his wife's wages on one of the prostitutes who descend like buzzards each time the carnival arrives in a new town. We want you to read our fortunes, Danilo says. He puts two coins down on the table to show he means business. You have no fortune, the old woman says, devouring the last bite of her ham and sucking her fingers clean. Everyone has a fortune, Pavla says. No, I'm telling you, you have none. Your fortune is that you have none. Now go away. If you're telling us we're poor, we hardly need to pay money to learn that, Danilo says. The woman shrugs, taking a bite of bread and chewing slowly. Take your money back, Pavla says to Danilo. He reaches for the coins, but the woman is quick, and her hand covers them before he gets there. You mean we have no luck, Pavla says? So the wolf is the smart one. Smart as a wolf. Smart as a fox, Pavla says. Wolf, fox, cat, dogs, they're all apparently smarter than that one. She looks directly at Danilo, and for a moment, Pavla is certain the woman can see perfectly. I'm smart enough to know it doesn't take a seer to tell us that we're down on our luck, Danilo says. I told you, I'm closed for business. Pavla whispers to Danilo that they should go. She hasn't eaten all day. You took my money, Danilo says. I want my fortune. All right, the woman says. Here it is. One of you will be brave, one of you will be a coward. One of you will believe, one of you will doubt. Which one? Pavla says, but Danilo interrupts her. But what about love, he asks. Will I find love? Love, the woman exclaims. All anyone wants to know about is love. My God, is there nothing more important on earth than that? Why don't you ask the necessary questions? Will I have food in my belly? Will I have all my teeth? Will I be able to urinate without pain? But no, it's always love. It's pathetic. But what is the answer? Pavla says quietly. She is not sure she wants to hear. Will he have love in his life? Yes, he will have love. No, he will not have love. It's all the same to me. Now get out. They are quiet as they walk the rest of the way home. The giant stands near his caravan, taking one of his epic pisses after a night of heavy drinking. He's fallen asleep during the endless evacuation, and Danilo and Pavla watch in awe as he tilts precariously towards his splatter. Just before he topples, he wakes himself with a snort, and they have to run to avoid the wayward geyser. Laughter rings out from the home of Juliska, the fattest woman. There is a happy person, Pavla thinks, and it is true. There is never a moment when that woman is not filled with mirth. Her joy seems to reside in the folds of her neck and the jiggle of her buttocks, which she can, amazingly, set to sway in opposite directions. Unlike some of the other performers whose lives of being tormented have made them hard-edged and bitter, Juliska takes as much pleasure in displaying herself as do those who pay to see her. As a result, she never receives the sorts of taunts or the barrage of flying objects that are Pavla's regular due. Pavla once snuck into Juliska's tent and watched her perform. The woman showed off the magnificence of her body as if she were displaying the most mouth-watering desserts. Here is my giant arm, she seemed to be saying, allowing a lucky patron to reach out a finger and set the fat into pendulous motion. Here is my mighty thigh. The men, for her patrons are mostly men, women not being the least entranced by flab, respond by treating her with enormous care, touching her as though she were something delicate. Because of her welcome and her generous love for them, she has been transposed in their mind into the statue of the Virgin they were allowed to carry in the processions when they were boys, bearing her giant wooden body aloft like a miracle. How proud they felt to be given the awesome responsibility to guard that simulacrum of sacred flesh. Pavla supposes it's different for Juliska and the giant to have lived with their curious bodies and their entire lives and who have never known themselves to be other than the porcine or enormous people they are. Had she remained a dwarf, she believes that she would have been as happy as Juliska, but she has become unfamiliar to herself. Thanks.
That was wonderful.
Yes,
thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So we were talking backstage about how both these books are sort of, they're so different, but they're both sort of social critique inside another kind of book, very different kinds of books. Sort of a fable, fairy tale, and mine. People keep calling it a thriller, and I so didn't set out to write a thriller, and so I feel very self-conscious.
What
about
do you
that.
Think of it as?
Just a book about
a book.
But I sort of feel like that about all my books, including the kids' books. So I feel like yours is so much about bodies and what is expected of bodies, and especially what is expected of female bodies, and how that might be resisted and subverted, and it's kind of, like it's kind of a fantasy of that as it plays out. Can you talk about that? Because I keep thinking about that as I've been.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the book, I think, ends up being sort of, it's about women and their bodies, and about the ways in which women's bodies are sort of suppressed and often reviled and often repressed in time immemorial and, of course, even now. And it's about a woman who goes through these series of transformations, not only because the world does not want her to be the thing that her body is, but also in a funny way is a way of saving herself. And so that it's as much as she's both a victim and not a victim, mm-hmm. in the way that I think people are. I don't think there's sort of a black and white about it. But it's sort of interesting because, and I want to ask you this question, because I didn't start out to write that book. I didn't say to myself, I want to write a book that's a treatise about women and their bodies. I wanted to write a really ripping good story.
And you did. It's not a treatise at all.
And the story that I started with was, the story about a dwarf who gets stretched, which is a story that, like the book that you read that was sort of the inspiration for you. I had read this obituary, which I don't know, a lot of people saw, actually. It was about 4 years ago. It was an obituary. It was in the New York Times about one of the last remaining munchkins. And in the obituary, I think he was one of the Lollipop Guild. And, it's funny. I went to Egypt to talk about this book, and I said that, and there was a blank face. Like, no one. And I was like, that's how American-centric we are. Anyway, and in fact, this man's parents tried to stretch him. Of course, it didn't work because, it couldn't work. But I thought, well, what if it had? And that's sort of what those. And then I wanted to write about a woman. I didn't want to write about a man. But really, I wanted to. I just kept saying, okay, well, why is somebody going to turn the page of this book? What happens to her? I didn't think, oh, it's about women and their bodies, and it's about repression, and it's about the political blah blah blah. And I think that's probably true of your book as well, because when I read your book, which I love. Aside from it being this incredibly heart-stopping story where, the anxiety is rife and the characters are so beautifully drawn, but it really is about, in my mind, very much about sort of American exceptionalism and the way in which Americans think they are sort of somehow beyond the kind of tragedies that befall other countries. And it's also about innocence and about the loss of innocence on so many levels, both for the children and for the parents and for everyone in the book, sort of. But the Americans most of all go in with a kind of innocence that Americans have, this kind of young adolescent, like, I can't, no one can kill me, innocence, which is, sort of maybe now we're learning something else in this world that we live in, but that's very much been the history. But I imagine that you too didn't start out that way, that
not at all. It really started with the pirate novel and with this idea of kids in danger don't know they're in danger. But there's a line in Highwind in Jamaica that I had underlined, and then I ran across this quote from Theodore Roosevelt, which is, Americans learn only from catastrophe and not from experience. And then the line I had underlined in A Highwind in Jamaica was, it is a fact that it takes experience before one can know what is a catastrophe and what is not. And so those, right? Which has just seemed truer every day. So those were the epigraphs from the beginning. So those were sort of hovering over it, but I never have any kind of game plan. I don't know where I'm going. And I sort of figure out what it is, what the themes are, what it is that I'm interested in the story as I go. So I really sort of figured out that it was about American exceptionalism and America's place in the world and that kind of innocence as I was writing it. And then you try to sort of pull it out more. Once you realize what it is,
right.
Then you try to make it better.
Although I think what makes the book so good, and I think this is probably true for all the kinds of books that I like, is that the author is not writing to the theme.
No, God, never.
And I think that when you read a book where you feel like the author is just writing towards this point, it becomes very cumbersome and very heavy, and you feel like you're being hit over the head with, meaning.
Yeah.
And I think that when a book sort of takes flight and when we feel sort of at the end of it that we've been taken away and that our minds are opened up to something new that we haven't experienced before, it's because the author allowed those sorts of meanings to be very sub rosa. Not sub rosa, is that the right word? Subterranean, for as long as is humanly possible.
Yeah.
And allow That's the true. Reader to I always feel like, well, I'm not the, analyzer of my own book. I'm the writer, and it's up to other people to decide what or what it doesn't mean.
Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing, because I'm not a very good analyzer.
No. I mean, when I finished this book, I kept saying to people, but what do you think it means? you know, and because I thought, oh, I'm going to have to talk about it, and I'm going to have to be in, you know, audiences like this and mm-hmm. tell people and have, you know, act as though I knew what it was. But truthfully, I was just saying, okay, well, what happens after she stretches? And then what happens when she's a wolf? And then what's she going to turn into next? And then what? And then mm-hmm. what? So, and I imagine with yours, it was very much the same.
I wrote the beginning of it until the kids disappear and then had no idea what would happen next and just stopped. And I'd written two of the kids' books, but not the third one. And the second one was very much the Empire Strikes Back book. You know, it didn't wrap things up. And kids were growing up, and kids were writing to me saying, okay, what happens next? And I didn't know. And so I put this aside and wrote the third kids' book and then went back to it. I still didn't know what would happen next and just kind of held my breath and decided I would figure it out.
You know, I want to ask you a question about the kid thing, because one of the things that's so wonderful about this book is that the children are really distinctive, and each of them has a very specific level of knowing and innocence that they're coping with in this very, very charged situation in which they're in incredible danger. But they based not only on their ages but also on their characters, they do and don't recognize the kind of danger that they're in. I mean, there's a 14-year-old girl, the Argentine girl, who is really on the cusp of her sexuality, and she has this preternatural instinct that she is in a kind of harm's way that is not true for the little girl. But I found that really fascinating, because it was both, you kind of tread this line, and what's also wonderful, I'm kind of babbling, but what's also wonderful is that in the middle of incredibly scary and charged situations, the kids think really kid thoughts. You know, they suddenly are like hungry, or they have to poop. Like in the middle of, like, but it's so right, because, you know, for who they are and their level of innocence and also the level of denial that they need to be in order to survive. So I guess my question is, having come from writing these three remarkable kids' books, was there any way in which you wrote kids differently?
That's a good question. I think the writing kids' books made my plot devising muscle stronger, so I definitely think it helped with that. And I think I've spent so much time talking to middle schoolers in the past 6 years that I really have, I think I already have a strong sense of connection to my own childhood self, but I really felt like I had spent a lot of time with kids in the past 6 years. And I also think the thing of having kind of ordinary thoughts, even in a crisis, is something that is true for all the characters, mm-hmm. less for the parents, because there's sort of two groups of people. There are the parents who have a lot of information about the world and none about what's happened, and the kids who know where they are but don't have as much information about the world. And also, within that, I think that the thing about human nature is the way we kind of find an even keel, and when things are, and we can kind of adjust. So when things are terrifying and horrible, we create a semblance of everyday life. And when things are as perfect as they could be, we find things to complain about and be scared of. And the kids, even when they're safe, are kind of pushing at what's scary to sort of figure out where safety is. So I feel like that was sort of going on in those kids, in those scenes where the kids are being themselves, even though they are separated from their parents.
But was that different in terms of how you approached writing kids for the...
In the first draft of this was too middle grade. It was too, not because of the content, but because the kids had too much agency and awareness of what was going on, and the people who helped them were too good at helping them. And kids are resourceful and resilient, and the kids in this are resourceful and resilient, but in the first draft they were too good at it, in the way that kids in kids' books are kind of supernaturally good at it, and their mentors and helpers are really good mentors and helpers. So one of the first things I did in the second draft was to put in sort of more chaos and confusion for the kids just about what was going on. And I think that was because that middle grade muscle was strong. Mm-hmm. And to make their main sort of helper younger, so sort of a kid also. And I think that was the sort of the big shift. It was harder to shift back to writing for grown-ups than it was to shift to writing for kids in the first place.
Yeah, I would imagine. And I mean, I think that the issue of fate, which I think Louise talked a little bit about, mm-hmm. and you know, the idea that that they're victims and not victims all throughout this book, you know, and people who are creating havoc are also victims of a kind, even the baddest people in the book. And I think that's something that I was trying also to think about when I was writing Little Nothing. I mean, I didn't want to write a book about a girl who is, you know, the world is coming to get her in any form that she's in, although this happens, but her ultimate transcendence, which is sort of this very paradoxical transcendence, is a kind of statement about identity, even when her identity is at its most perilous and most taken away. And I think it's kind of interesting to think about when you're in these moments of great pressure, how identity, even at a moment when you might be extinguished, your identity is the strongest in a way. I don't know whether that's something you were thinking about when you were writing.
No, but I love that. No, I want to think
well,
about it.
If you'd written this book,
if
you'd been
thinking
about
thought
it.
A lot about it. They're both close. They're both third person, different perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do Pavla and Danilo?
It's all those. And the parents and
the
parents.
Yeah, the parents too. You're also a short story writer. I feel like shifting close third person, where there's an overall narrator who is allied to a different character in each chapter and sort of passes the story off among them, feels really natural to me. And I think it's because I started as a short story writer. I don't know if that's true.
I don't know. I mean, I've written one novel I wrote in the first person, this novel called The God of War, but I mostly am comfortable writing in close third. I don't know why. I don't find it that comfortable to write the I character. So, and what I like to do is I like to sort of be way up high and then zoom down in and then mm-hmm. come back up and then zoom in. And I like to have that kind of latitude where you can see the whole world and then you can be so close to someone's consciousness and they can't see the whole world. And I think that's a really, that's kind of the narrative guise that I'm most comfortable in. Have you written
that's
first?
So interesting. I never go up high.
Oh.
I'm always, but here, when you were talking about the... about the shifting and each person having their own. When you know those nature documentaries like Blue Planet and Planet mm-hmm. Earth? I was watching one of those when I was writing my first novel, which was also shifting, which was also close third person chapter by chapter. And they have the baby seal hiding under the ice. And there's a polar bear paw coming down through the ice and you see the baby seal cringing. And you so want the baby seal to live. You do not want the polar bear to get the baby seal. And then they shift, and they're up on this vast, empty ice, and you see the mother polar bear and her cub coming across the ice.
And they're so hungry.
And they've just come out of hibernation, and if they don't get a baby seal to eat, the mother won't make milk and the baby will die. And you so want her to get a baby seal. And they do that up and down the food chain. Like, you root for the herring ball that the seal is eating. Like, you... think like spin, get away from the seals, and I like, not that these characters want to eat each other, but I like the idea that you can shift and be on the side of a character who's like you were saying, the victims are there's a reason they're a victimizer. Like, I feel like that thing of even if that character is in conflict with someone from the chapter before, you are on the side of them while that you're in that chapter. So that's kind of like, that's why I think about
it. Yeah, and I think with you know, Little Nothing also, because I was working with this whole trope of the fairy tale, there is a kind of narrative authorial voice in a fairy tale that,
of course.
I mean, fairy tales are not usually told with any degree of psychological depth at all. I mean, a fairy tale is told like this, you know, a mother had a child, the child was ugly, so the mother took her to the woods and killed her. that's the degree, that's a degree of psychological depth that you get in a fairy tale. But I think because there is this kind of, it's a told tale. I wanted Little Nothing to feel like it was a tale that was being told. Mm-hmm. And there is a kind of, there's a theme that runs through the book about telling tales. And the mother of Pavla tells her these tales. And by the end of the story itself becomes a tale that's then told to a young child. And so I think I wanted to be able to sort of widen out and have that authorial voice every so often to remind a reader that they were being told a tale. that it wasn't simply a kind of a psychological realism, that it was also a tale that was being told.
Okay, so the moment you decided what if the stretching worked, was that the moment you knew this was going to have a fairy tale-like tone?
I think I knew it was going to have a fairy tale-like tone the minute I started to write the book, because I thought somehow when I started thinking about a dwarf and I started thinking about, and this particular guy who was he was Eastern European, the Munchkin, and in the obit, it said he had been born in Bohemia, which is no longer a country. It's now the Czech Republic. But even though that language suddenly put me in the world of fairy tales. So mm-hmm. it was just the language of, a dwarf. I don't know that he was called a dwarf in the obit. He was probably called something more correct. But Bohemia, all that stuff, I just suddenly, there I was. I was in Eastern Europe, and I was in, and there were times when I was writing the book where I felt like I need to put it in a particular time and place, and it needs to have some historical accuracy, and should it be the First World, there's a war in the book, should it be the First World War? But every time I kind of started to narrow in on some, you know, historical markers, the whole thing just sort of flattened out and became not the book that it should be. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it had to live in this kind of fable-like non-time, in the way that Once Upon a Time could be 100 years ago or 400 years ago or, you know, 1,000 years ago. And so I think the minute I read that obit, that's where I was. I was in a world. And then I was scared because I thought, I've never done that. How do I do that? And I don't know whether you experienced that same thing, because, you know, you've written a range of different kinds of narratives, but you've certainly never written anything that has the quality of a thriller, shall we say. It's not, you know, and I don't know whether that was something that scared you or...
I'm always scared.
Yeah.
All the time. but I think that feeling of being scared of the thing is the best, is like the most promising feeling. Yeah. And I've sort of learned to trust it and to know that when I feel like I don't know what I'm doing, or I've painted myself into a corner in the book or out, or, you know, thinking about the book, it's always when I have no idea what I'm doing that the best things come,
right.
I think.
Yeah. I mean, I feel the same way, although I can't say that I'm particularly comfortable. I spent about a year before sitting down to write, sort of second-guessing, you know, wondering why I'm even interested in this, why anybody else would be interested in this, you know, I don't even know how to do that.
Wait, so are you writing during that time?
No, I'm, as my friends will attest, I'm, you know, shrieking and moaning and, you know, I'm reading a lot, I'm thinking endlessly, but I'm sort of...
Are you thinking about the book?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the book, and then I'm
reading.
That's
amazing to me.
So you just sit and write.
I can't think unless I'm writing. Like, I can't imagine the book in my head unless I'm typing.
Oh, I can't either, but I'm doing a lot of, I can't say that I'm making any forward progress, but I'm sort of, I feel like I'm just sort of trying to find a way in. Like, I'm sort of circling an idea. Like, I had this idea, you know, this dwarf is stretched. So I sat with that idea for probably 6 to 8 months, kind of circling it in my mind and trying to figure out, like, well, what is the doorway in? And I wait to hear, like, some sound, or I'll read a short story and I'll think, okay, that's a tone that I can sort of surf on that tone. Or, you know, or I just a sentence and I think, okay, I'll start there. But it takes me, I really feel like I'm knocking on a fortress for like a really long time. And then finally I hit a spot that's a little bit loose and then I can pound it harder. Hmm. I write, but I don't imagine a story in full without writing it. But
it
takes
me
a long
better.
Time to get to that first moment of like hearing it. I don't know.
What other books were you reading? What were the books that
I read a fair amount of fairy tales just to get into the rhythm of the language and to sort of get a sense of sort of the general tropes. I read a lot of Eastern European literature because I wanted to kind of, even though it's in translation, so you don't exactly know what the rhythms are, I wanted to be in the rhythm, in the language. I wanted to hear about what trees were growing, what the weather was, I wanted to be surrounded in that world. So I read a lot of, you know, the obvious stuff like Kafka, but I also read Kertész, and I read Agnieszka, Agata Christoph, and a lot of Eastern European writers. And then, what else did I read? Then I read stuff that was germane to the book. I mean, a lot of the book has to do with plumbing, And so I read a lot about plumbing and about, you know, the history of plumbing, and it has a lot to do with plumbing.
Yeah, it does, in a really great way.
So you know, stuff like that, where, and that always gives you great ideas. But I think I was just trying to sort of steep myself in a slightly different language and in different flowers and animals and, you know, whatever was cropping up in those stories, sort of like trying to take a trip without leaving my, and what, besides that one book, the High Wind Jamaica, what did you read?
That was really the one book that started it. And then I think the other books, or I guess there was a book called Lions in Shadow by Joseph Wamba that was about people trying to get across the U.S. border. And I was reading all the news stories about unaccompanied minors trying to get across the border. Carrie Joji Fukunaga's movie, Sin Nombre. And probably all the Joan Didion I was reading in my 20s. But then other, those are the books that...
What did the Didion, what was that about for you?
Well, they're all about lost children and Central America. I don't know, there's, I
feel Salvador like there's a lot
and all
of that, yeah.
Yeah.
And did you know that the book was going to be, from the get-go, based in L.A., that was, the characters were from L.A., the American characters?
I started it with L.A. I'd always wanted to write a book about L.A., but L.A. is so big and so various, and it's so hard to sort of figure out even how to get into that fortress, right, and where, how you would do that. And also, I don't know if this is true. I feel like I'm from Montana, and I've written a lot about Montana while I live in L.A. And I think sometimes it's hard to write about a place you're in every day. You get kind of overwhelmed by the real world detail of it, and it's better to have a little distance from it. So I feel like the solution was to write a novel about LA people that takes place almost entirely in Central America.
Well, I think I've written, almost all my work has been about California in one way or another. And when I started this book, I thought, I'm absolutely going to write a book that doesn't take place in California. That was like my marching orders to myself. And I also thought, I'm going to write a book that is not based in reality at all, because I had just come off of Mary Coyne, which was this very reality-based book. It was about the Depression. And so that was my sort of, I said to myself, I want to write not in California and not having anything to do with the world that I live in.
Mm-hmm.
So very far from it.
I do that too. My first book, some of the stories were set in Montana. Not all of them, but people sort of decided that I was a Montana writer, and I just felt like, okay, I'm going to write a book in which no one ever mentions Montana or goes there or thinks about it ever. And, you know, I feel like it's good to do that, to sort of...
Well, I also feel, for me, it's like, it's just, I want to write differently. I mean, you have so many books you get to write in your life, and for me, I'm restless inside of my mind, and so I want to be able to sort of flex a lot of different muscles. I mean, I don't know whether this was true for you, but, and then we should open it up for questions after, but it was really fun to write something that felt like I didn't know that I had that in me, like the world. I mean, I'm not a reader of fantasy. I'm not a reader of fairy tales in general. So to write something that was so not in my wheelhouse felt like exciting, because I felt like, okay, I discovered something in me that I didn't know was there, and I don't, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, should we open it up for questions? I think that someone's coming around with a mic.
Thank you both for coming. You're writers I've admired so much for so long. And Miley, I was reading your book in one fell swoop.
Oh, thank you.
And I had the thought, because the world has changed so much in the last year, that you have these American parents going, you know, needing to assert their Americanness to get some help. And I wondered if you thought, if you wrote it now, that part would all be different.
It would be so different. It really is so interesting how much the world changed, like, immediately after it went into copy editing. I finished it sort of last summer, and in September, I often don't have a title, and I was really proud of myself for having had a title that everyone liked, and then someone raised some questions about the title, and they thought it was maybe too negative and might be too off-putting, and so we went through, like, 2 weeks of trying to find another title before coming back to this, and it was... By November, no one was saying it was too negative anymore. And it is set so much in a particular moment that there's no ambassador that they can deal with, because the Senate won't approve the president's pick. Like, it's so much in a very particular moment that I thought was going to kind of keep going. You know, I had no idea how much. But here's the thing. So yes, it would have been different. I feel like everything is different now. I don't know what to do next. But it's about smart, well-meaning, liberal people who think that they've worried about everything they need to worry about, so none of it can happen, who get completely blindsided by something they were not expecting. So in that way, it's much more contemporary than I thought it was when I set out to write a novel based on a 1929 novel 6 years ago. But then I sort of realized, you know, 1929 was a year for getting blindsided too. So yeah, it definitely would have changed. And those epigraphs feel, it's weird to me that those epigraphs were attached to it so long ago when they just feel so much about this moment. Yeah. Yeah.
Next question. Hi, this is for both of you. When you said you start writing and you don't know where the story's going, I'm curious if you always write like that, and if you don't, if the editing process is different when you do write like that?
I always write like that. I have no idea. I'm not a particularly good plot person, so I would never be able to sort of foretell a plot. It's not what I'm very good at. And so I'm just literally writing, you know, okay, well, like they got out of the forest, so now where are they? Okay, they're, you know, all right, well, now they're on a plane. What happens on a plane if they're out, you know? So, and then what's the weather? I'm trying to create environments that help me propel the story forward, because I'm not very good at like, oh, and then somebody came and, you know, took away. I'm not good at that stuff. So, but I, for whether or not this is justification, but going back to what Miley has said, I sort of believe for myself that if I do know where I'm going, things are not going to be very good, that it's going to be very boring, because I'm not going to surprise myself, and so I'm not going to surprise you. But so I've sort of have learned to trust my not knowingness, and I've come up with some strategies to help myself, for instance, weather, or for instance, place, or, you know, and just being very inside of a person's mind to think, okay, well, what are they thinking now that happened, and then where are they going to, you know, it's kind of like acting a little bit. So that's how it is for me. And then, once you've got the draft, then you're in a much more analytical place going through it, and you're sort of looking at things with more idea of what you're doing, because it's there in front of you. I don't know if it's the same for you.
Yeah, I write the first draft really feeling like I'm feeling my way forward in a dark room. But then eventually you get something that you can see and look at, and so then you go back and forth between macro and micro in whatever way you can. I used to make a timeline, now I use Scrivener, which is great, and I feel like then I do become more analytical about it, just making sure, you know, I'm spending enough time with each of the characters, and I'm passing off the story to the right people at the right time, and I know the kids, what time it is in the kids' world, and what time it is in the parents', you know, that I'm making sure it all matches up, and then I go back in where I have no idea, and you just stand the characters up and let them talk to each other and see where it goes.
Thank you both for a great discussion. I was wondering whether, and for both of you, do you, having written long and short and middle grade and various things, do you know, for example, Marissa, when you saw that obituary, did you have a feeling that there was a novel in this, or did it feel like this could be a story? And how does that reveal itself, whether there's something short or long coming from an idea? And having finished these books, are you feeling something short or long coming on?
I always know, you know, it's like an idea sort of appears to me and it feels like it has enough resonance and bigness and places to go that it's a novel, or it feels like that entire story exists in a very compacted way and it's a short story. So I've never had the experience of having something I thought was a story expand into a novel, or something that I thought was a novel become a short story. For some reason, it's just rhythmically, you know, I just see it that what it is. I'm kind of doing both in a funny way. I mean, I'm starting a new novel, but I've also been, over this long year where I've been just circling my idea, I have been writing short stories, and I've been kind of interested in. But I find it very tricky to go to change rhythms. You know, once I'm in a short story rhythm for a number of stories, then I can do a number of them. But coming from a novel to a short story is like, it's like shifting too many gears at once. It takes a long time for me to get back to how to compress information. You know, in a short story, you're choosing, you know, five things, and those five things are going to paint an entire universe. And in a novel, you have, you know, 300 things. So it's hard for me to shift back to that rhythm. But then once I'm in it, I stay there for a while. So that's been my experience. But what about you?
Yeah, I also feel like I can tell, like, there are novel-sized ideas and short story-sized ideas. And it is hard to go back. It's like you've been running marathons and now you have to sprint, you know, and that seems hard. But I love the idea you've been doing. I've been doing nothing but book tour for the last month, so I don't know what, I'm not doing anything right now.
Well, I think you're allowed. You just put out a book.
Mine just came out. But I would like to go back to short stories. I feel like a novel is like a long marriage and short stories are like dating. And the novel, you know, it's there every morning. You know what it is. You don't have to come up with a whole new world in it and new characters and everything. And short stories, there's the freshness of each one, and you don't have to spend so much time with it. But it's also a lot of work to, like, figure out who these people are again. That's a good question.
Marissa, this is a question for you. You had mentioned the transcendence. I'm going to try to not make this a spoiler at the end of the book. And as you know, I love that ending and that paradox of when we become, like, to become less substantial and become more, like, sort of fully realized. That identity paradox was very cool. So the question is, did you approach that ending in the same way as the other stuff that you're describing, where you didn't know it was going to happen and you just looked inside the story and she did that, and then you thought, and then you realized later what theme was emerging, or did you have more of a plan?
Well, you know, I knew what was, about three quarters of the way through the book, I felt like that was what was going to happen at the end, and I didn't know how it would happen. Well, part of it was I just, you know, I had this woman who kept transforming into things, and at some point the story has to end, so, like, what's going to happen? You know, she can't keep changing endlessly. The book has to end. And so at a certain point I understood that was going to be the ending, and I don't mean to be coy, but for those of you who might want to read the book, I don't want to give it away. But and then I had to do the hard work of what we were talking about before, is not writing towards that in this kind of, like, drive the car, you know, but get there in a kind of, in an organic way that felt earned and that wouldn't feel like, oh, well, that's a cool idea, but I didn't really buy it. I mean, I don't know. I think we all have that feeling sometimes. We read books and we feel like, oh, that's a cool idea, but it doesn't move me, you know? And I think what moves you is when the cool idea had to happen. It's like that that inevitability thing, that surprising inevitability that people talk about when they talk about, like, Flannery O'Connor or something. The thing that's the most absurd, but it's also the only thing that could have happened. And so in a way I realized that this is the only thing that can happen in this story. She can't stop transforming, because that would obviate the logic of the whole book. Why would she stop? So there was really only one other option. And then it was to try to get there in a way that felt very much earned. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for having us here. So nice.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.